Hi, and welcome to the Web Directions podcast series. The following presentation, Ubiquity, with Mark Pesci, was recorded at Web Directions South in Sydney on September 28, 2006. For more materials from this conference series, please visit webdirections.org. This podcast is licensed by Web Directions and Mark Pesci under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 2.5 license. Please include this audio license notice with any copy or derivative work of the podcast that you distribute. And now, over to Mark.
Known internationally as the man who fused virtual reality with the World Wide Web to bring us VRML, Mark Pesci has explored the frontiers of media and technology for a quarter of a century. If you don't already know Mark from his writing in the area of new media, specifically of late on hyperdistribution, you may know him from the ABC program The New Inventors, where he's been a panellist for the last two seasons. Mark came to Australia to chair the Emerging Media and Interactive Design program at AFTERS, and has since moved on to an appointment at Sydney Uni and to found his own media and technology consultancy, Future Street. He's written and spoken extensively on digital social networks and, most importantly and relevantly, explored the question of what will really happen when we're really all connected, a subject he's going to riff on further today with his presentation, Ubiquity, exploring hyperconnectivity and the challenges it presents for designers. Please welcome the presenter of our closing keynote for Web Directions 2006, Mark Pesci.
Good afternoon. I realize that I am the person standing between you and beer, so we will be direct. So first, let me just talk about me a little bit. You understand now why I shave my head. I've been a software engineer more or less full-time in various guises since about 1982. My first computer was a TRS-80, and I've been programming since I was about 15 years old. And I started working after I got thrown out of MIT back in 1982 and did the thing that all MIT dropouts do, which was start to code. And I started working in networking almost immediately and worked on a technology called X25, which some of the older folks in the audience might remember. It was a forerunner of the packet-switched internet of today. And I realized that I got really an almost unnatural thrill out of making computers communicate well with each other. And that was satisfying until I read a little article with an interview by a gentleman named Jaron Lanier back in 1990, who is considered to be the father of virtual reality. And he said something very salient. He said, virtual reality is not the television of the future, it's the telephone of the future. In other words, it's a new way to communicate with people. And that really sort of triggered something in me, that I realized that all of my work making computers communicate with computers was really just leading up to me working on ways for computers to communicate better with people. And so I was in the right place at the right time in 1993 to put pieces together to create the virtual reality modeling language. I think probably the first short-lived web technology of the 1990s, although people do still use it, in fact. It had enormous promise, none of which was actually ever fulfilled. But that said, it was a very interesting time to be doing work on the web. And when I did my first prototypes of it, I mailed this fellow in Switzerland named Tim Berners-Lee and said, you know, you were writing a little bit on your blog, such as it was, about virtual reality, and here we've got this little application, and I got from him an invitation to come to the first international conference of the World Wide Web. And this is a lovely conference, and I think we need to thank Maxine and everyone else for an amazing time this week. It's been very instructive. And that conference, the first web conference, was without a doubt the most exciting event I've ever been to. The conference from at CERN in Switzerland, where it was held, held 350 people. When Tim Berners-Lee did his keynote, 500 people were in that room, even though 330 people was the limit for registrations to the conference. People just got on airplanes, they just got on trains, and they went to Geneva because something in May of 1994 was driving them to be there for what was going to happen. They just snuck in because they had to be there at the very beginning of this thing that every person in that room knew was going to change the world. And of course, that was long ago. It was before the bubble, it was before the bust. It was before the bubble, before this bubble. It was before the hype. It was a time when absolutely anything seemed possible. And then for a long time, that feeling of expansiveness that accompanied the very first days of the web got occluded by IPOs and ship dates and business plans and all that stuff. And that's all fine. You know, that's all good stuff. But that sense of expansiveness, that anything was possible, that got taken away for a while. And really, the web sort of got dull for 5 years. But I'm happy to report that it's back. There's another boom. There's more hype, we all know that. And there's another bubble, we all know that. But who cares? Because right now, right where we are, we're in a time and we're in a place, and you can feel the energy, where anything is possible. So I want to talk about the heart of that possibility. And the heart of that possibility comes to the fact that we're starting to understand what the web can do for us as human beings. Now, I spend a lot of time these days, basically, and to riff off of Kelly, being an anthropologist, studying people where they live and what they do and how they do it. And Kelly, you shouldn't be afraid to call yourself an anthropologist. Just because someone has a PhD doesn't make them better at anthropology than you, all right? You can do the literature, you can do the research. Now, you shouldn't just say, I'm an anthropologist and throw your ideas out there. You're doing field work. You're doing user testing. And of course, user testing and anthropology, well, what's the difference between these? Well, it's perhaps a little bit semantic. It's perhaps a little bit more specialized. But every one of you people who are putting something in front of a person and then watching how they interact with it, you're all anthropologists. So I'm studying what it means to be human in the sense of trying to understand how we interact with ourselves, with our technologies, with each other. And what I try to do is observe what people do just by themselves, or when they're interacting with a piece of technology, or when they're in groups. And so, to do that, I want to get to some basic ideas of what people do and what people are about, which means I have to peel back the layers. I have to peel back the layer of the web. I have to peel back the layer of the internet. I have to peel back the layer of technology, electricity, language even. So you go before, you try to get down to more and more essential human characteristics. And so you get to something that looks like what we looked like 5 million years ago, which is a lot like this. Now, scientists just in the last 90 days have been releasing an enormous amount of research about the differences between chimpanzees and human beings, because we've now got both genomes sequenced and we can take a look at the genomes side by side. And we found out that we are at least 98% identical. We found some very important differences. For example, chimpanzees have very strong jaw muscles. A chimpanzee could bite your finger off without even thinking about it. It's much more difficult for a human being to bite someone's finger off because chimpanzees have very strong jaw muscles. Well, those very strong jaw muscles are the same things that keep their heads so small, because they have to have massive bones on the side of their heads to anchor the jaw muscles. So chimpanzees have smaller heads and their heads can't grow. On the other hand, human beings have a defect in that gene. We have weak jaws, we can have big heads. And, well, we've got some other characteristics. We have shorter arms, we don't scrape our knuckles, we have less body hair. And of course, we have bigger brains. Now, question of the day. We found the gene just 2 weeks ago. We found the gene that gives us the bigger brains. Okay, great. What's it for? What kind of thing, what do you get as a benefit for having a bigger brain? Because, you know, if you look at genetics, video games and nanotechnology are not our genetic destiny. That's not the reason that nature gave us a great big brain. It's something way more profound. It's way more basic than just how smart we are. And it starts with the baseline, the common ancestor of both the chimpanzees. Yeah, there we go. Both the chimpanzees and human beings. And we don't quite know what it looks like. That's an artist's conception. But the thing that we know about that particular creature back about 6 million years ago is that it was a very social animal. The thing that we look at when we look at both chimpanzees and human beings is that they're both intensely social creatures. You don't find them alone in the wild. They don't exist in isolation. They're always existing in all sorts of groups, which have all sorts of interesting power dynamics. We talk about alpha males. We talk about beta males, alpha females, beta females. We talk about hierarchies and dominance. And all of these characteristics are social characteristics that show up in chimpanzees and in human beings. Makes the life very exciting. So why are we social? That's the next question you want to ask. What's going on there? Why is it important to be social? Well, if you're social, you will live longer. You are less likely to be eaten by a lion in the savanna of Africa if someone's shouting, hey, there's a lion over there. You are less likely to eat a poison berry and die if someone says, you know, the last time I ate that, I nearly died. So there are a lot of very good reasons for being social, because when you're social, you stand a chance of actually living long enough to pass on your genes to the next generation. And of course, socialness has a lot of different qualities. Chimpanzees groom each other in order to reinforce their social bonds. You know what human beings do? We gossip. We gossip about everything. We gossip about the weather, we gossip about our friends, we gossip about celebrities. And people have been gossiping about celebrities for as long as we can find written records. This is not a new characteristic. And so what we can tell is that the social qualities that we have as human beings, they're essential to us. They're essential to our origins. But that said, and even though it seems like it's effortless and it's easy to be social, it is in fact one of the most difficult tasks that we can perform. For example, what we're learning now as we're studying the brain is that the brain comes to life, it boots up in stages. And basically the last of those stages to boot up happens as you're entering your teenage years. And it's all the parts of you that integrate your own social behavior. This, we've discovered, is why teenagers are so incredibly miserable. All right? It's because they're becoming conscious of their capabilities in social culture, but haven't had any practice. So all they're doing is making mistakes and making mistakes and making mistakes. And so this causes a lot of friction as they make their way into being a full adult. And what they're learning to do is they're learning to model all of their social interactions. That's what we've also learned from studying the brain, is that you actually carry around inside of you, inside of your brain, a model of all of the people that you are closest to in the world. And you interact with that model all the time. And the more accurate that model is, the better you are at manipulating that model, the more adept you'll be socially. And one of the things that we've started to learn as we're starting to understand autism is that one of the major deficiencies of autism is that there's literally a biological deficit in the brain that prevents people from modeling the behavior of others. But of course, it's not easy to model. It actually takes an enormous amount of brain power. It takes us years to learn. And it's happening in a very new part of the brain. I love it. I pulled this off of Google Images, it's in Polish. But if you take a look at the yellow part at the front, that's the neocortex, or the new brain. That's what we got. And that's where all the social modeling is taking place. And of course, we have more neocortex than any other animal on the planet. So, if theory holds out, that means we should be able to hold more social relationships in our head than anyone else. And anthropologists have been studying the size of social relationships both in the human world, and then also animal psychologists have been studying this, and zoologists in the world of the primates. And so we know that there's an average number of relationships that any human being holds, which is the same number that would be in the average tribal unit, or chimpanzees in the average troop. And that number is called the Dunbar number. And John Dunbar, again, an anthropologist, took a look at the size of the neocortex of all the primates, including man, and mapped it against the number of units in their social groupings. This is, to me, this is the most beautiful chart I've ever seen, because what it's telling us is that the number of people you can hold in your head and model is directly related to the amount of gray matter you have upstairs. Human beings get more than all the primates, so our Dunbar number is about 150. For chimpanzees that come about next, it's about 30, and it drops off thereafter. All right? So what this telling us is that the reason that we've got a bigger brain than the chimpanzees, the reason, not to make video games, not to make rocket ships, it's so that we can hold a bigger social network in our heads than any of the other animals, because it confers benefits. That's what being human is all about. Okay, so I've explained what social networks really are. And I love the web connection social network. It's really cute. By the way, please add me as your friends. I'm really down. I want to have some more friends. But, of course, the term social network has become the topic du jour on the internet. And we all know there's a lot of stories about social networks and how much money they cost and how many people are using them at any point in time. And the first question I'm going to ask you is MySpace really like your neocortex? No. No, it's not. It's not. But I want to tell you a story. It's a story about Friendster. Now, Friendster went online in March of 2003. I was still living in Los Angeles at the time. And I started getting these sort of reminder emails from one of my very good friends in San Francisco, Karen Marcello. Oh, there's this thing called Friendster. You should join it, because Friendster keeps on sending me messages about it. And I just ignored it. Oh, yes, whatever. Next big web thing, whatever. And finally, in July, in between trips somewhere, I actually sat down and signed up to Friendster and was relatively late within my circle of friends in signing up to Friendster. And I realized that this was, in fact, a visualization, an implementation of this whole idea of the 6 degrees of separation. That, in fact, I could actually create a social network and link directly to my friends. And there was something that was incredibly exciting about this. And I proceeded to fall into a state of what I can only call web crack, which was for the next 7 days, with the exception of the brief periods of sleep, I was haggard in front of the monitor, mousing around, searching my friends' social networks in depth so that I could find another first-degree friend that I would add to my network, because I had a goal and I was going to reach 100 first-degree friends in that network, damn it, and I was going to have a million third-degree contacts, damn it, and by the end of the week, I'd pretty much gotten both of those goals. And there was this enormously energizing feeling about that exposure to the idea of the social network. There was something behind that, because what it was doing is it was tickling those parts of my brain that have already had several tens of millions of years of evolution behind them to understand social networks. And it was the first time that that had actually been reflected in front of the monitor. But it was only just a taste. And of course, Friendster rose and fell and is trying to fire sale itself off. And Orkut, well, rose and fell, unless you're in Brazil, in which case it is the big social network. And then MySpace and Facebook currently rule the roost. Now, why is MySpace big? Well, there's this idea called path dependence. It's also known as the fax effect or the network effect, which is the more people who sign into a particular system, the more likely it is other people will sign into that system to use it. And after a while, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So once MySpace got to a particular degree of infiltration within particular units of culture, it would spread virally very naturally thereafter. Now, why it got to that space first, say, and not Friendster? Personally, I think the reason is that Friendster is still among the slowest websites that I'll ever use. I was actually trying to do some stuff today before this talk, and it took me 5 minutes to do basic operations on that site. Could be that. It could be that MySpace really well-integrated media, which was something people wanted that Friendster never has. We don't really know one reason why MySpace is better than Friendster. But I mean, again, it's not that complicated a thing. And it's not that interesting beyond the fact that I can sort of create this map of my social networks. And there's a dark secret about all these social networks. It's something that we don't really like to talk about, but it's actually really apparent. They're a lot of work. Now, I have a MySpace page. There it is. I don't really do very much with it. I basically got it because my friends bullied me, and there she is, into getting it. I'm too busy doing other things to maintain my MySpace page. I don't link to media. People will join my MySpace page, and maybe I'll log in long enough for that. But I write, I lecture, I blog, I teach, I invent, I live my life, and I don't really have a lot of time for my MySpace page. So my page isn't really all that reflective of me. It's stale. It's sort of this ghostly simulacrum. It's not really me because, you know, who has the time? And you're all busy people. How many of you actually spend the time, and let me get a show of hands here, how many of you actually spend the time on MySpace or another social networking site to keep it really well informed about what you're up to? Okay, so out of a crowd of, say, 300 people-ish, we have four people. So we're talking about 2 or 3% of you are actually making that investment. And this is the Achilles heel of the social networks as we know them today. They're passive. They sit there and they wait for you to feed them all of this information about what's going on in your life. And unless you feed it to them, like a shark that stops swimming in the water, they die. They absolutely stop moving. Because they're passive. They sit there. They basically just wait. And if you don't have the time to keep it up, well, it's like what would happen if Google stopped indexing the web every single moment of every single day. From the moment they stopped, everything in their database would grow more and more stale until it's completely useless. So, that's the dark secret of social networks. And if you're a 15-year-old with maybe nothing but time in your hands, you have the time to invest in MySpace to be able to make it something that's relatively reflective of yourself. But here's the thing. We have now all of this built-in organic circuitry for social networking. We have it all up here to manage the social networks. And yet what we're being given are these pieces of crap digital social networks. And that's a problem because what really could be going on here is so much more profound than what is actually going on. And this is the main point that I want to make. Because what we're basically being asked to do is to feed these networks with our time. And in the 21st century, time is the non-renewable resource. But there are so many ways to take this, and that's the essence of the social network. It's understanding the connections between the entities, between the people in the social network. This is enormously important. This is enormously powerful. And let me illustrate how powerful it is by giving you two examples. All right, I have, let's say, 1 million first-degree contacts in Friendster, or whatever the equivalent might be in MySpace. Why am I not using that as a spam filter? All right, it's not the only thing I need for a spam filter, but if I'm getting an email and it's not coming from a third-degree contact, that means it's a cold call, which means it is instantly very suspicious. Google could implement that in an afternoon because they could just tie Orkut together with Gmail. And bam. But they haven't, because no one's thinking about the latent power inside the social network, which is that it represents information flows. Because these are people. And what do people do? We're social. We communicate. Let me give you another example. I do a lot of work understanding media distribution. And I've come up with a basic understanding of how media distribution networks work in the real world. On any given day, in the recent couple of months, I will wake up, and because I have a lot of friends in America, my emails from America will have arrived, and some of them will be business related, some of them will be family related, and the rest of them are from friends. And the ones that are from friends have, over the period of the last several years, been reduced from some talking missive into a URL. And quite often, it's a URL to YouTube. Right? And you all know exactly what I'm talking about. You're getting a link to a page, you're getting a link to some resource, or generally you're getting a link to YouTube. What's happening here? All right? What's happening is that each of us, embedded in our own social networks of friends, we're constantly finding things, and we're thinking in our heads, gee, this is really cute. In fact, I think Nicola might like this, or I think Maxine might like this, and what's the next thing we do? We forward it on to them. So this is the basic operation of a social network. This is what a social network is actually doing. And we're doing it using email, which is not necessarily designed to be the best tool for it. But we are a social network exchanging media all the time. We're sharing media in these ad hoc social networks. They're not being backed up by some fancy technology like MySpace. We're just doing it with email in our brains. We find things, we filter them, and we forward them. And more, this is what the essence of our electronic experience is, the three Fs. All right? So those are two powerful things that social networks could do and are doing, and yet the space of the digital social network, the MySpaces of the world, have no connection to these basic ideas of what social networks are actually being used for. So there's a lot of potential here for social networks to be social accelerators, to help us communicate more effectively than we ever could. In fact, I'm sure that social networks can do for human communication what Wikipedia is doing for human knowledge. It's possible. Okay, but how? Well, we're ignoring something that's very obvious. In fact, when you are a living, breathing human being in the 21st century, in the West anyway, in the Western world, you generate every single moment of your existence reams of data, what we might call the data shadow. And let me just consider now a very basic sense of data that you generate when you sit in front of the computer. You generate emails, you generate URLs, you generate instant messaging, you have Skypes, you might play World of Warcraft. All of this electronic communication is laden with social relevance. All of this communication can tell us, can tell you who's important and why they're important. It can be used to model your social network. But you know what's happening to all of that vital information? It's being poured on the floor. We don't save it. We don't think about it. We don't store it in any way that's socially relevant. That's an incredible waste of incredibly valuable information. And the interesting thing about your data shadow is these are the parts of the data shadow that you have control over. There are other parts of your data shadow that you do not have control over. This is a photograph of me that was taken at the only lecture I will ever give wearing a sarong. That was my opening line in that lecture. And now I know for sure it is the only lecture I will ever give in a sarong, because a photograph of me was snapped and uploaded to Flickr, where absolutely everyone in the universe can download it, including Kelly, who used it. All right? So you have the data shadow that you're generating, and then the entire universe, as every mobile phone has a camera in it, and microphones, and iPods, and everything, more and more of the universe is being captured and being placed into an accessible and tagged format. And that's also your data shadow. And then, of course, there's another offender. It's not just the computer that's being left out of the equation for all the social data. There's an even bigger offender. All right? You have in each of your phones a call list. You have also a list of the SMSs you've sent and received. Is there any way in any of your phones for you to export that in any format that's useful to anything? It's in the phone, and it's inert. It's useless. What were they thinking? All right? The truth of the matter is they weren't thinking at all. And the interesting thing is once you start to think about it even just a little bit, an entire universe opens up. Because one day, Patty Mays at MIT thought, gee, if I sort of look at what people are listening to with music, maybe I can map that into what other people are listening to in music and then make recommendations. And that became Firefly, which became the heart of Amazon's recommendation service. All Amazon does is watch your user behavior when you're making selections and then compare that against other users who've made similar selections and use that to make more recommendations. So it's a social network, it's an anonymous social network, but it's incredibly effective. And all they're doing is really just watching one little specific aspect of behavior. Now, we are in the era of the mashups, and the era of the mashup, it's beautiful. It's absolutely a wonderful thing. Every time I see another great mashup, I just get a really big smile. But as beautiful as it all is, it's not nearly enough. We're just at the beginning of the job. We need to think about how to mash up every bit of socially relevant data that passes through all of our various electronic devices. We need to think about doing it comprehensively, and we need to do it obsessively. That's what the peer-to-peer revolution is really about. It's not so much about sharing files. It's about sharing our lives as social beings. That's where it gets interesting. The computers themselves have the capability if we put them to that task. And the interesting thing here is that the web is the universal glue. That battle is over. It's won. The web is the thing that glues all of these devices together, because no matter what device it is now, it talks to the web and can be talked to by the web. And so the challenge to all of you in this room as web developers is to think about how to reinvent your social networks, how to do all of your design work with the eye to the fact that there's a wealth of social data that's being presented by the user in every interaction they're having with your work, and that that has utility value to you and to them. Okay, we've forgotten one thing. We've forgotten the real world. Now, the real world gets left behind an awful lot these days, because it isn't virtual. It doesn't come through the computers. And because it doesn't come through the computers, it doesn't really exist. But our native technology for dealing with social networks, our neocortexes, they're oriented entirely to the real world. And what we find is that the true problems we have with technology is when we have to juggle these real and virtual worlds, because we are really well suited to juggling social relationships in the real world. Our computers are theoretically, if not in actuality, well suited to juggling relationships in the virtual world. So what we need to think about then is seamless ways to tie them together. And the interesting thing is that we already have the device that can tie them together, because we have a device that sits squarely at the intersection between the real and the virtual. Now, Kelly pointed out yesterday, and she exposed in this email interview that I had with her, that I have an extremely emotional relationship with my phone, and that's actually the model of phone that I have. And of course, apparently none of the other people in the survey admitted that they had an emotional relationship, and I think all lying. Let me tell you why. If you dropped your mobile phone into the toilet, all right, first off, this happens all the time and we know it, right? First off, what are you doing with your mobile phone in the toilet? First off. Second off, shit, I've got to spend a couple $100 on a mobile phone. And then third off, shit, I've just lost my entire social life. All right? You have an intensely emotional relationship with the device, because that device is a nexus for all sorts of social communication. So, when we talk about the device as a nexus, and of course it's not a nexus for machine communication, it's a nexus for human communication. All right. We all know, everyone in this room has probably gotten a text that made their day, or a text that ruined their day, or a call that made their day or ruined their day. The phone has become something that's completely sort of seamlessly integrated into our lives, so much so that maybe we don't think we have an emotional attachment to it, because it's literally become a prosthesis. It's like a pair of eyeglasses. And I don't necessarily have an emotional relationship to my eyeglasses until I can't find them when I get out of bed in the morning. So, the telephone is the nexus. It's the place where the real world and the physical world touch, because it's always with you, and yet it's always connected to that virtual world. And yet, most of the time, when that phone is sitting in your pocket or in your purse, it's doing nothing at all. It is just sitting there waiting for something to make its day. All right? It's waiting for a text. It's waiting for a call. It's waiting for you to text. It's waiting for you to call. Otherwise, it is sitting there and basically just slowly sucking down the battery. And again, I want to point out, it's an enormous waste. What I want us to do is to start thinking about that device as a center point for all sorts of design activities related to the social space, related to social work on the web, but also related to social work in the real world. So let's reconceive of the mobile phone as something that's going to play a very active role. It's going to be the Batman to the data shadow. It's going to be the constant companion to that data shadow. And it's going to be doing something that I like to call active listening. All right? If we use the mobile phone to practice active listening, we can start to get a handle on our data shadows. And it's just the same for all of these other types of electronic communication. Our email needs to listen. Our web browsers need to listen. IM and Skype and World of Warcraft and all these other things that we're doing, they all need to listen. So do our phones. Okay. Enough preaching. I can tell you till I'm blue in the face about the way I'd like to see things. But I can code. So I can do more than tell you about the way I'd like to see things. I can tell you about work that I've done very recently, which tries to point away to the way I want things to be. All right? I decided that I would develop an application that would demonstrate whether I could produce a model of someone's social network just by listening really, really hard. So what I did was decided to use the one feature of a mobile phone that most mobile phones have, Bluetooth. And the nice thing about Bluetooth is Bluetooth basically puts you into an environment where you can be electronically sensed. And every Bluetooth device in the world, whether it's a Macintosh or a mobile phone or whatever it might be, has a unique address associated with it, like an IP number or a MAC address. And so I can tell when you're near me based on the fact that I'm going to see your number. And because we both have our intense relationships with our phones, where I'm always carrying my phone and you're always carrying your phone, my phone can sense the fact that your phone is near, and I can make the pretty good inference that I'm near you. And if I do that listening for a long period of time, I can start to build a model up about who in the real world is more related to me than other people based on the amount of time they've been spending around me. And so I spent 6 months working with John Tonkin, who's another interactive designer from Sydney, developing an application for a mobile phone, an application for PC and Mac and Linux and all that stuff, a back-end database application using the LAMP stack of technologies. And it's all open source. You can go to relationalspace.org and grab all the pieces of it. And then we deployed this for a week at the InterSymposium on Electronic Art, which is one of the large interactive art festivals in the world, which was held in San Jose in the first week of August. And so we covered the entire exhibition space and the entire conference space with sensors and also with people with their mobile phones that they were also using as sensors, gathering data. And then by the end of the week, we were able to go to the database, and this is the sort of front end, the visualization engine to the database, and I could then put in my phone, and this actually happens to be one of the organizers of the show. His phone is called Wittershins, and we were able to sort of hit the button, and then what was produced from that was we were able to actually produce a map of his social relationships, at least as far as that part of the conference was concerned. So just by letting the devices listen actively, just by letting them listen to what's going on, and then allowing that data to be digested, you can actually produce a model of the social network. So that's a basic idea, and it seems to work. So that's, I think, where all of this is going. This is where the devices in our pockets are going, and this is where they start to interact now with our devices out on the net. Because these devices are always on, and they're always invisible, and they're ubiquitous. And that ubiquity and that utility now can be fed into models of social networks. So I would hope, and this is just the hope, that the next Web Directions conference next year, or maybe the year after that, when I walk into this room, my phone isn't sitting there passively, and your Macs and your phones aren't sitting there passively. But in fact, what happens is 100 different conversations. Some of them are brief, and some of them are long. And these conversations will exchange names and contacts and friends. So you're going to do your friend-to-friend search to figure out who you know in common, and interests and playlists and feeds and links and media. All of the data that we're constantly generating in our passage in the world with all of this electronic technology is going to be shared with each other, because the value of this information increases with the degree that it's shared. It becomes more socially useful. And all of this has to happen invisibly. That's the interesting thing about this. This is the part of the web that doesn't have an interface. This is the part of the web that is pervasive, that is ubiquitous, and is invisible, and yet sets the stage for everything else. So, okay, I walk into this room and there's this amazing conversation happening in my pocket with all these devices. Fine. And then, when I go to a computer, there's an amazing conversation that's happening with that computer. So that computer now has a lot of social context that it can then use, whether it's my computer or someone else's computer, to produce another layer of depth relationships. And we've already talked about some of those when I just talked about spam filtering and media distribution. And those are I think, simple things. Those are simple versions of what people will start to develop once that wealth of social information is constantly made available because the phone connected through the 3G network to some huge database that's growing and growing and growing and growing, the more that database grows, and that is a visualization from my space of a single person's network. Once that database grows and becomes more useful, it starts to have real-world utility and can help you live your life more effectively and can help you navigate an information-rich environment and a noise-rich environment. And I know that it'll work because that was the point of the last 6 months of coding. I know that these technologies will work. It's a matter of how they're going to be deployed and when they're going to be deployed. And we see people nibbling at the problem. Delicious is nibbling at the problem. Flickr is nibbling at the problem. None of the phone companies are nibbling at the problem. Helio, which integrates MySpace with a 3G mobile phone, could nibble at this problem in a really substantial way. No, you know what you can do? You can post photos and blog from your phone. Whoop-de-fucking-do. All right? In fact, my MySpace page should be going, this is who I'm hanging out with right now. And this is where I'm hanging out. All right? It should be a very rich, it should be a very interactive, a very, very sort of well-integrated experience of the fact that you have this social nexus with you. And it's communicating with the web. But it's all right. Because there's my favorite quote in all of science fiction is this one. William Gibson, the street finds its own uses for things, uses its makers never intended. And this is, I think, the challenge to you as web developers, which is that if you don't get in front of this, you get run down by it because your users are the people who will take the components that you're putting out there and start mashing them up to create their own solutions. Because they're all being overwhelmed by this mismatch between the virtual world and the real world that isn't being met by the social networks as they exist. But we're developing the methodologies. We're developing techniques for digital social ubiquity. And as we do that, everything changes again. It won't be the web 1.0, it won't be the web 2.0, it won't be the web 3.0, it'll be this other thing. And that's why the future is so bright. That is why the future is so wide open right now. Because this is not a bubble. This is not hype. This is where we're moving together in ubiquity. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed Ubiquity with Mark Pesce. For more materials from the Web Directions Conference series, please visit webdirections.org.